This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Suzanne Ex at Indiana University and Dr. Julie Mead at the University of Wisconsin-Madison about a policy brief they have recently written about the way school vouchers and charter schools have opened the door to discriminatory practices at odds with federal laws and the protections they offer diverse students. Doctors Ex and Mead argue that policymakers and legislators need to take potential discrimination into account as they experiment with both of these efforts to inject market principles into American schools. Without explicit legislative oversight, we run the risk of perpetuating inequities that run counter to the ideal of equal education for all. Welcome, Suzanne and Julie. To begin with, could you describe some of the recent events that led you to look at the issue of school privatization and discrimination more closely?
Sure. Well, this is Suzanne. And for me, it started a few years ago. I was reading a New York Times article about schools in Georgia that were receiving their private religious schools that were receiving public money. And the article reported that LGBT kids were being expelled or not even being admitted to these private religious schools. And it dawned on me, what are some of the legal issues that could be involved in such type of discriminatory practices? And then I looked at our own law in Indiana. We have a voucher law and a charter law. And I looked at the state legislation for charters to see what the anti-discrimination provisions provided, and then compared that to the voucher legislation in our state. And what I found was a little bit surprising that the voucher legislation only provided for anti-discrimination provisions specifically for race, ethnicity, and national origin, I believe. And I saw Julie Mead at a conference, and we see each other at education law meetings and conferences a few times a year. And I brought this issue up with her, and she had a similar interest in exploring this issue. And a few years ago, we did our initial study that was published in the Peabody Journal at Vanderbilt University, where we did an analysis of different state laws and what protections, if any, did they provide with regard to anti-discrimination provisions in schools that accept voucher money.
I would just add for me, this is Julie, that my interest in this topic has been fairly longstanding. In fact, I first began studying vouchers and charters and various forms of parental choice in the 1990s. And the reason that I was motivated to look at them really was because I was first trained as a teacher of kids who are deaf and hard of hearing. And as more and more states talked about what they termed reforms, these kind of choice programs as reforms, I was concerned about whether or not the kids that I had been teaching would in fact be considered part of these reforms or excluded from them. So it's been a longstanding interest of mine.
So what are the primary forms of discrimination federal laws have sought to reduce or eliminate? And which of these laws have had the most far-reaching consequences with regard to the reduction of discrimination in schools?
Well, there's a long list of the various laws that protect students from discriminatory practices in public schools. And we go over those in the brief. Suzanne and I both teach school law courses at our universities, and both of us teach a whole host of cases that have to do with essentially the same question, and that's can a public institution omit service to portions of the public? And so those cases were often brought under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. So that's the kind of the home, if you will, of our conceptions of what we call equal protection in that provision, or in that provision of the Constitution. And in addition to that constitutional protection, the federal legislature has adopted a series of laws that likewise protect or add additional protections to various protected groups. So I'll just quickly go through the laundry list, but if you want to read more about them, you can look at the brief. But the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act both prohibit discrimination on the basis of disability. You add to that the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which provides funding to provide services for that same population. We have Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and that act applies to entities that receive federal financial dollars and prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin. Title VII protects employees from discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Title IX protects students and staff from discrimination on the basis of sex for any educational institution that receives federal dollars. And then finally, the Equal Educational Opportunities Act requires states and local school districts to ensure equal opportunity on the basis of race, color, sex, or national origin. So that's the laundry list of those protections. And I would not be able to say that we can do without any of them. They all serve a purpose. They all came about and to some degree because of litigation from folks prior to the adoption of those laws, bringing lawsuits under the 14th Amendment to say, hey, we are part of public too, and everyone should be able to participate in publicly funded benefits.
And I just might add, too, this is Suzanne. I don't know if everyone is aware that in 2017, there was a discussion going on within the Department of Education about whether we would consider increasing federal funding for both vouchers and charter programs in the U.S. and maybe even establishing a federal voucher program that was discussed a while back. Well, in 2017, the U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, testified before the Senate Appropriations Committee about the fiscal year 2018 budget, about this increase in funding, federal funding. And Secretary DeVos was asked whether she would prohibit private schools from discriminating against LGBTQ students and students with disabilities under a federal voucher program if one were to exist. And during that questioning, it was with Representative Catherine Clark from the U.S. House, Secretary DeVos repeatedly stated that schools that receive federal funds must follow federal law. And she said that a few times during this questioning in 2017 about the 2018 budget. And we'll get to more of the details about the laws, but several of these laws have religious exemptions. So, for example, Title IX includes an express exemption for religious organizations, which provides that Title IX shall not apply to an educational institution which is controlled by a religious organization if the application of this subsection would not be consistent with the religious tenets of such organization. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as the interview continues, but I just wanted to point that out as well.
Well, actually, could you say more about ways in which private schools have played a role in perpetuating discriminatory practices in the past?
Well, I think you can see evidence of this both in the very first example that I gave you from the New York Times article in Georgia, where it was reported that private religious schools that were receiving public money were expelling gay students. And then you can also see it more recently. In fact, we open our policy brief with this example. I live in Indiana, and it's been in the news quite a bit lately. And she was even on the Ellen Show. There was a teacher at a private religious school in Indianapolis. And she had been a guidance counselor there for many, many years, a very beloved guidance counselor. And when one of the parishioners showed her marriage license, she had married her same-sex partner of many, many years, she was put on paid administrative leave. And there's similar exemptions under, I just went over the Title IX exemption, but Title VII, which prohibits discrimination in employment, has kind of a similar type of exemption called the ministerial exemption. And basically, you know, the argument in this case will be whether she's a minister, considered a minister of the school. And if she is, the ministerial exemption could apply, and Title VII then, which prohibits discrimination based on sex. And in our circuit, the Seventh Circuit, includes, you know, goes beyond sex, that which includes sexual orientation, that, you know, she could not find protections under Title VII if this ministerial exemption applied in this context. So there are exemptions under Title IX that I just recently mentioned, and then as well as Title VII with regard to discrimination and employment. I don't know if Julie wants to add any of the other, any other detailed exemptions, but that is a way that private religious schools that receive public money are able to kind of skirt some of these federal laws.
Right. And I would add just a couple of things. One, and that's just a reminder that that actually the very first voucher programs came into being right after the Supreme Court ordered states that all, that had segregated school systems to desegregate. And so you had some places in the country where they would they literally closed their public schools and then gave everyone a voucher to go to a private school, knowing that the there were no private schools that at that time served African-American students. So that connection between vouchers and discrimination has a rather long and ugly history. It took the Supreme Court to declare that that practice was unconstitutional for states to stop that practice in the, you know, the 50s and 60s. You know, more contemporary, you know, Suzanne walked through a number of contemporary issues, but I think that what is considered discrimination as a matter of law is not the same in private schools as it is in public schools. So, you know, private schools typically don't serve kids with disabilities, particularly those who have severe disabilities with complicated needs for services. Likewise, many private schools don't serve kids who have to have special instruction in order to learn English because English is not their first language. So, those practices, that leave out or exclude segments of the population are, both from our past, but unfortunately from our present as well.
In your policy brief, you also raised the distinction between being a state actor as opposed to a private actor as it relates to the way that private and public institutions are able to respond to these laws with regard to discrimination. What do you mean by this? And why is it an important issue as we kind of look at this concern at this point in time?
Well, being a state actor is often what you might consider the trigger for whether or not a law applies at all. So it comes from actually the 14th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment begins, no state shall, right? And so that phrase, no state shall, when courts are interpreting whether the 14th Amendment applies, they look to see whether or not there is a governmental state actor involved. As opposed to a private person who is not associated with the government. That thinking has been reinforced, if you will, in the federal laws that require there to be a recipient of federal dollars before the law applies. So if you're in a private school that is not receiving any federal funds and it's being operated by private entities, there's no governmental agency that is operating the school, that's a private actor. And that particular distinction was really what the Supreme Court thought about when they considered whether or not state voucher programs were constitutional under the Establishment of Religion Clause of the First Amendment. And this happened in a case called Zelman versus Simmons-Harris in 2002. And there, what the court concluded was because the state made the voucher, if you will, available to families without regard to whether or not they were religious or not, or about where they were going to spend the voucher. And in fact, the parents could spend the voucher at both non-religious schools or religious schools, public schools or private schools. They determined that the decision maker was that of who to spend the money, if you will, was the private person, not the government that made the money available, and therefore they upheld it as constitutional. You can imagine that those who challenged the law had the opposite viewpoint, and this was one of those close decisions. It was a 5-4 decision, and the dissent agreed that the merely making the money available was state action enough to create unconstitutionality, but the majority of the court disagreed. So it's a very important concept.
With regard to state action, Julie did a great job providing an overview within the context of vouchers. And we hit upon the issue of state action within the context of charter schools a bit in our brief as well. So In addition, potential for voucher schools to discriminate, some have raised similar concerns about charter schools. Specifically, charter schools are considered public schools, but some court decisions, and there are not many, but some court decisions have raised questions about whether they are indeed public, whether charter schools are indeed public. If more courts continue to treat charter schools as private schools, many of the same concerns that we raise about vouchers might also occur within the charter context. And I'll just give you one quick example. In one case, an Arizona teacher's contract wasn't renewed after there were some concerns about some suspicious phone contacts that he had had with a female student. And the teacher sued the charter school, alleged that his liberty interests had been violated, he couldn't find work, and filed this lawsuit. And at issue in this case was whether the charter school was a state actor. A private nonprofit management company ran this particular charter school. And upholding the district court's dismissal of the case, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that while a private entity may be considered a state actor for some purposes, the charter school, it is still possible to function as a private actor in other ways. So this decision and a few others have left some of us wondering if charter schools are indeed truly public. You know, certainly they're public schools, but some of these cases that are addressing state action are really interesting to watch develop.
So there really is kind of an emerging kind of understanding about just how ambiguous this notion of state and private is as it relates to these new kind of educational experiments. Your policy brief really focuses on the way that contradictory or ambiguous federal or state laws and practices have opened the door to differing forms of discrimination. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, I think this relates back to our earlier study that I mentioned that was published at Vanderbilt in the Peabody Journal. And then we cite to that earlier study in our policy brief, where we went and looked at state voucher laws across the U.S. to see what groups were included. Did they include English language learners? Did they include students with disabilities? Did they prohibit discrimination based on sex, based on sexual orientation, race? What was included in these state laws? And what we found and what we cite in our policy brief as well is that very, very few states, if any, provide comprehensive anti-discrimination protections in the state voucher laws. So some do a little bit better than others, but you note, too, as I said earlier in the interview, that there's a distinction oftentimes between a state's voucher law and a state's charter school law in terms of who is included in the anti-discrimination provision.
You also indicate that there's a problem with just the kind of programming that charter schools and private schools offer and the impact that that can then have on their accessibility to a broader range of students. What do you mean by this? And do you have any thoughts about how that programming could be potentially changed to not kind of lead to that form of discrimination?
Well, I'll start with that one. There are kind of two ways that programming can limit who in fact attends a school. And the first is if the programming has a particular focus, it's designed to attract a particular group of students. And if care isn't taken to make sure that in fact that curricular focus has broad appeal across various demographic groups, you could wind up with a school that serves a niche so structured that it appears to omit or exclude other students. The other issue I call the most excellent promise problem. And what I mean by that is that, and this is in particular true about charter schools. It's also true about voucher schools, but let's use charter schools again as an example, where they understand that they have obligations under the law. So they understand that the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, applies and that they have to provide services to children with disabilities. But, you know, it's a single school and they're not going to hire personnel if they don't have a need for it. So a parent with, and the example we use in the brief is, for example, a parent of a child with autism who is looking for an educational home for their child and comes to a particular school might say, you know, do you have the expertise to serve my child? And the charter school will say, no, but if you enroll your child here, we will be certain to get the services and the expertise that your child needs. That parent, that rational parent, would have to essentially gamble on a promise to enroll their child there. And they might be, in that circumstance, motivated to shop elsewhere and find a program or a school that already has that expertise. So that means then that the school, by virtue of what it made readily available, has in a way constructed who is in their student body population. And it also creates an opportunity for someone, if they wanted to exploit that by, you know, purposefully determining not to serve and not to offer difficult to serve programming or get programming for kids who have extensive service needs as a way to control costs. So in that case, under the law, as long as, you know, they haven't purposely said we won't take your child because your child has a disability, they haven't violated the law per se, but the result is the same in that this charter school likely serves fewer, if any, kids with disabilities.
As you've mentioned, one of the current flashpoints with regard to discrimination has been tied to the refusal of some religious schools to admit LGBT students or fire LGBT teachers. Why have these institutions been able to get away with these practices? And what does case law have to say about rectifying this form of injustice?
Well, that's a great question. And I hinted at it before a little bit with these exemptions or exceptions to federal laws. And I'll provide a little bit more detail, give Title VII as a more detailed example. So as I mentioned, there's a ministerial exemption to employment discrimination laws, including Title VII. And this exemption permits religious organizations to choose and dismiss their school leaders without government interference. It's rooted in First Amendment's free exercise and establishment clauses. And although this exemption would permit religious organizations a lot of leeway in hiring and firing, it doesn't extend to non-ministerial employees. So it goes back to that example that I gave where the guidance counselor was put on paid administrative leave. Is she considered a ministerial employee? So there can only be, let's say, an exclusion of a gay teacher or refusal to accommodate a teacher with a disability, for example, if that teacher falls inside this ministerial designation. So this would arguably not include a calculus or a Spanish teacher, for example. However, who's considered a minister is continuing to be examined by courts. So, for example, in a fairly recent Fifth Circuit case, an employee who played the organ at Mass was considered a minister, and his age discrimination lawsuit was banned. So in sum, this exemption that applies to Title VII, which prohibits discrimination in employment, applies only to those employees who perform essentially religious functions. So whether it's the Indiana guidance counselor or the other, you know, 10 teachers I've seen in the past few years get fired once the private religious school, you know, found out that they married their same-sex partner. And if they would bring a lawsuit in this type of case, it would come down to this oftentimes it would come down to this ministerial exemption, you know, are they performing essentially religious functions? So you can see how these federal laws don't always apply within the private context.
I would just add that in terms of this particular population, there are even instances of policies in private schools receiving vouchers that would permit the private school to exclude or to expel a student, not because the student has done anything wrong or is identifies as LGBT, but that their parents do. So it applies fairly broadly, and it raises a number of concerns.
We have only a couple of minutes left, but I'd be grateful if you could speak to the four recommendations you believe would begin to update federal and state laws so that they better acknowledge changes in the educational landscape that have taken place over the past three decades. Could you say more about those four recommendations?
Sure. They're we think, actually fairly modest. But the first is that Congress should amend the anti-discrimination laws to make clarify and to explicitly say that they apply to charter schools and to voucher schools, that private schools that participate in voucher programs, tax credit scholarship programs, or education savings account programs, ways that public money subsidizes private education. We also think that there should be a consideration by federal agencies of withholding governmental benefits from private schools who don't meet non-discrimination standards. This is something that has been done in the past, for example, for private schools that discriminate on the basis of race, withholding, for example, an IRS tax-exempt status would be an example. A third recommendation is for state legislatures to make explicit in their charter school and voucher statutes that any school that participates in the program has to promise not to discriminate on any basis, race, color, sex, class, gender identity, sexual orientation, disability, ethnicity, national origin, or primary language, for example. And that finally, state legislatures should amend charter school laws to ensure that they examine issues of exclusion throughout the charter school process. So that is in the charter school proposal, contract, oversight, revocation, and renewal provisions, to make sure that those charter schools are both attracting and retaining reasonably diverse student populations.
Well, many thanks, Suzanne and Julie, for your efforts to give more prominence to these concerns and alert our elected representatives and their constituents to the role they need to be playing to assure that our schools truly fulfill their mission to educate all students. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. February's Education Interview of the Month will feature Kevin Wellner and Chris Saldana, who have been studying the emergence of a new form of marketing that involves the recruitment of teachers to be brand ambassadors capable of influencing their students' consumer choices and their colleagues' use of educational technologies. They will consider ethical, legal, and policy issues related to this phenomenon. I invite you to join us again for another podcast.